But I don't think that that's necessarily where real connection or real intimacy comes from. I think that real intimacy comes from interpreting someone and allowing yourself to be interpreted. So it doesn't necessarily come from direct statements.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Lauren Euler, whose debut novel, Fake Accounts, takes place after Donald Trump's election win in 2016. The novel begins when a young woman goes snooping through her boyfriend's phone, certain he's cheating on her, and instead finds out he's been operating an Instagram account of conspiracy theories. Lauren Euler's essays on books and culture have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and elsewhere. Lauren, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks so much for having me.
First off, I'd love it if you could read an excerpt from Fake Accounts. Can you begin reading on page 117? I'm hoping you might be able to start with the sentence that begins, "It was compared to white noise so often." You know, I thought it was a really good description of social media.
Sure. Yes. So at this point in the novel, the narrator has moved from New York City to Berlin because, among other things, she's discovered that her boyfriend has an anonymous, very popular conspiracy theory meme account on Instagram. And this has sent her into a sort of number of tailspins. And she's relocated to Berlin, where they met, and finds herself not sort of reborn in the sort of stereotypical eat, pray, love kind of way, but like more addicted to the internet than she ever has been before, because she has nothing to distract her. But something terrible that she's realized is that now that she's moved to another country and is in a different time zone, the internet isn't the same. So she has even less sort of opportunities to waste her time than she had before. It was compared to white noise so often for a reason. So many people talking, mumbling, murmuring, muttering, suggesting, gently reminding, chiming in, jumping in, just wanting to add, just reminding, just asking, just wondering, just letting that sink in, just telling, just saying, just wanting to say, just screaming, just whispering, in all lowercase letters, in all caps, with punctuation, with no punctuation, with photos, with GIFs, with related links, pay attention to me. Saying something as irrelevant to the wider world as, I'm in a bad mood, or I can't get out of bed, elicited commiseration, and offering commiseration to similar expressions made me feel I had participated in a banal but important ecosystem. There were so many people in bad moods at any given time. All we had to do was find each other. We could pretend something good, connection, had come of our turning to technology to deal with boredom, loneliness, rejection, heartbreak, irrational rage, Weltschmerz, ennui, frustration with the writing process. We were all self-centered together, supporting each other as we propped up the social media companies. Suddenly finding myself ahead of everyone, spinning my wheels, with no one to acknowledge my existence at the customary intervals, I entered a state of twitchy, frantic boredom, fixating on what I could not stop considering the real news from the United States, though when I was living my real life there, I had insisted social media was not part of it, but rather some aberration, new, ephemeral, a phase passing too quickly to warrant serious inclusion in a summary of my world. It fit in a summary of the world, certainly, but it did not reflect the lofty perch from which I gazed upon it. The world as I thought it should be.
Thank you. I loved the energy of that reading. Lauren, what was the impetus for Fake Accounts? Why write a book, a novel of all things, about social media?
I think my first sort of thoughts about it were about the sort of social dynamics that were happening on social media. So not in this sort of grand, the way that I'm talking about in this passage is sort of grand, like collective understanding of it, but really the sort of banal, pathetic day-to-day interactions that I was noticing and the sort of social interactions that I was having or that I was watching my peers have online were very interesting to me. And they seemed to me very sort of typical, not of what we consider social media, not of something new, but of something that has been going on for forever, right? Like they're just indicative of bad things about the way that people act when they are jealous or annoyed or scared or anything like that. So I really wanted to write something that sort of captured how it does feel different, but it's actually not so different from what has always gone on among people. And then I think, too, I wanted to write something that was taking place right around the time Trump was inaugurated. So right in its very specific moment, not because I thought that the specific moment was necessarily important, though obviously it was, but I was interested in sort of trying to meet the idea that you could, it would be very difficult to write a novel about this crazy time, right? Because so many absurd things were happening that are so, we see them as so specific to the moment, but actually I think they have sort of long-lasting ramifications and sort of the ideas that we were sort of thinking about at the time persist, right? Like it hasn't, nothing has radically changed in 4 years such that my novel is irrelevant, I hope.
I'm wondering how you came to the structure of the book as a whole. Were you ever tempted to use the structure of social media?
I think generally I always wanted to write a sort of more straight through novel with long paragraphs and like a beginning, middle, and end. And there's like backstory and character development and things like that. So I wasn't tempted to write in fragments, but I, when I did write that parody section of fragments, I really understood why people do it because it's super fun. It's really easy. And that's part of why it's fun, because you can just sort of like have an idea, try it out. If it doesn't work, you cut it. But you also don't really have to cut it, because I think if you're thinking about it, it probably has some relationship to your text in some way. And so you can depend on the reader to make the connections between the fragments. And that is how social media works as well. I think that over time, you read people's posts like they are characters, and you sort of come to know them and you make inferences about them and their lives in a way that I think initially you don't necessarily see that when you're just sort of like looking at someone's timeline suddenly. But over time, you know who's in a relationship, who's broken up with their boyfriend, like who's having a mental breakdown. Why are they having a mental breakdown? You can discern that really easily. And I think that that also is kind of how a sort of ideal fragmented narrative works, right? Like there's something developing over time that you just have to put together in your mind. And that kind of relates a little bit to the idea of a conspiracy theory or a conspiratorial reading. But obviously, there are some differences as well. Hopefully, you're not reading all novels conspiratorially.
Oh, I wonder what that would look like.
I think that that's like an intentional juxtaposition on my part, right? Like, at what point are you going to become a conspiratorial reader of me? And are you going to think about that while you're reading this text, which is definitely a novel? And obviously, you know, I think the plot, which has some twists, makes it clear that it can't all be me, because, of course, like, this did not happened to me. I didn't have a boyfriend who was an internet conspiracy theorist, or did I? But so I think it just emphasizes different things about that like experience of reading.
This protagonist seems alone or in a sort of isolation. You know, she calls herself alluringly evasive. Is that solitude kind of a character trait or even an indictment of social media's ability to make us feel these things while theoretically being part of that community? Your protagonist says, were we not all supposed to be at least a little important online?
Yeah, totally. I think that throughout the course of the book, she becomes more sort of alienated from her life. And it's not just Felix, her boyfriend's sort of revealing that he is lying to her in this kind of grand, absurd way. But also increasingly, she feels like she can't tell any of her friends about it necessarily. Or if she does, she has to do it in a sort of performance, like laughing about it ironically. I think that she's weirdly reliable, right? Like there's someone who has like a very good perspective on politics or social life or whatever, and they have a terrible perspective on something else. She feels sort of trapped on all sides by the parameters of the like social game that she's found herself in. And I think part of it is because she's a blogger. And so she understands like the ways in which the crowd and the cloud can sort of turn on you at a moment's notice. And she also understands the ways that you can sort of gain and lose attention very well. And I think what's disturbing to her, and what I think was part of my impetus for writing the book, was how people in her offline life, I don't like to say real life because I think both are real, but her offline life started mimicking the way that people online acted. So they not just saying the same sorts of things in person, but like dismissing serious conversation in the same kinds of ways, and this kind of like jokey, like, oh, you need to go to therapy. This sort of therapy has become a kind of meme on Twitter, I think, at times. And she meets a friend in Berlin who is like, I've decided to stop reading the news, but is also sort of parroting all of these like cliches about feminism and about politics that were circulating at the time. And she just feels kind of trapped on all sides. And she starts coming up with these fake personas, and she goes on a bunch of OkCupid dates, and she makes up a different personality each time. But I think she has all these fantasies about being caught lying and sort of like having to reveal her true self in whatever way, and having this sort of like moment of revelation that never really comes. And I think that those fantasies speak to this, what you're talking about, this really alienated, alone feeling that she has being surrounded by all these people that she basically can't talk to in a real meaningful way.
There are moments of vulnerability there, whether they're perceived or actually present. What's your relationship to vulnerability? How do you write a character who's both vulnerable and, like your protagonist, very clever? And do you consider your protagonist vulnerable in this book?
I think that there's this quickness to sort of understand that idea of vulnerability in this very two-dimensional way. And it's very interesting, having read a lot of my reviews, some people accuse the book of lacking vulnerability in any way. And I think that, of course, you can say that. But I also think that there are moments of, as you say, real like sadness, embarrassment. She's ashamed a lot. And also this feeling, this persistent feeling of alienation that appears again and again, I see it as vulnerability. But I think that we're sort of conditioned to want, particularly from a female character, like a moment of like abject revelation, like an epiphany of some kind, like crying. And also that she, not, you know, the narrator does cry in the book, but she doesn't dwell on it, right? Like there's not, she doesn't have this sort of grand breakdown that I feel that maybe some people want from her and sort of expect from her, because it's true. As you're going throughout the book, you're watching her make these sort of obviously bad, weird decisions that are going to make her kind of more miserable than she was before. But because the decisions are not so dramatic and they're kind of banal, right? None of her friends sort of call her out on them. And she resists them when they're trying to tell her, you know, maybe you should move to Berlin. You're trying to deal with your problems in an oversimplified way. And she's like, well, you don't even actually know what my problems are, so you can't tell me what to do. But there are all these moments where, yes, I think that the reader can totally see around her and see what she's doing. But I think part of what I was interested in was representing a person, which I encounter this all the time, and I probably am this person sometimes, who is knowingly sort of like making a bad decision, but they're doing it so slowly. And like, it's such a small thing relatively that you can't really stop them. And you're not even really going to like talk them out of it because they're sure about it, but it's clearly the bad decision. And in retrospect, they're going to be like, that's so embarrassing. Why did I do that? So I think you can think of her that way. But also, I think there's a moment kind of not early on in the book, but in sort of in the beginning, middle of the book, where she goes out to dinner with one of her really old friends. And the friend is sort of looking at her in a concerned way and saying like she isn't dealing with her problems effectively or something like this. And the narrator thinks to herself, this is a person who has seen me like crying so many times. I was having a breakdown, and she came and took care of me at my house and like yelled at my roommate for being insensitive towards me. And now she's not seeing the full picture of me, what's going on with me. And she gets very upset about this and has this a little bit of a moment of clarity where she admits to the reader that she sort of understands why Felix was doing the conspiracy theory Instagram account and why he would live a life of basically lying and deception and like memeing the world, because the world is not dedicated to seeing anyone in this sort of three-dimensional way, as it seems to her. And then she almost gets hit by a bicycle.
You know, you do mention in the book, or the narrator mentions in the book, that right now on social media, it's a thing for people to express their feelings, you know,
it's breakdown central.
Yeah. To be expressive, to admit when you're feeling down, sad. People are telling everyone about their lives all the time. Why did you resist making this character, who is online a lot and all the time? Why did you make this character resist that particular trope?
At one point, someone that she knows is involved in this like gossip ring, and someone who is involved in the scandal, someone is cheating on their boyfriend basically, a woman goes online and has a kind of breakdown about it and is like, never date this person. He's a liar and a garbage like freak or whatever, and to post a picture of her ex-boyfriend. And the narrator's like, I was really envious of that because she totally abandoned any sense of decorum or like self-preservation and was really just like acting out of pure like desire for revenge. And I think that the narrator understands that that's wrong and that's like a sort of fleeting, very temporary pleasure to do that. And then that the sort of shame that will follow you from that is much worse. But I think like telling people directly what your feelings are is not, it's interesting that people online are so sort of, like I was saying earlier, like therapy has become a meme and there's this real emphasis on expressing yourself clearly and talking your feelings out and things like that. But it's interesting because I think there's this idea that if you declare your feelings, particularly if they're in a kind of like very clear thesis statement, right, that people are going to listen to you and that they should. But I don't think that that's necessarily where real connection or real intimacy comes from. I think that real intimacy comes from interpreting someone and allowing yourself to be interpreted. So it doesn't necessarily come from direct statements. So I think maybe the narrator sees that it's a trap and it's basically just a way to get this like quick hit of attention and people sort of paying attention to you. But it's not all attention is created equal, I guess.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to A Conversation with Lauren Euler, the debut novelist of Fake Accounts. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I usually like to give my headlines the opportunity to, you know, talk about something that they haven't yet been given the opportunity to talk about. If someone hasn't asked you a question you've anticipated, or, you know, if there's something about the book that you want listeners to know, I'm happy to give you that space now.
Oh, well, do you want to talk about women's issues? Because I used to work at a women's website. I worked at Broadly, which was the Women's Vertical Advice. And I grew up reading women's magazines. And when I was writing this book, I really did think of it as like a kind of perverse or like inversion of like the stereotypical like woman goes abroad and finds herself thing, or like a bad boyfriend novel, as one of my friends called it. It's like a bad boyfriend novel that's not at all about the boyfriend. It's like mostly about her. And I really did think of it this way. But I mostly got questions about like the form and the structure and autofiction and like ideas about the internet and technology and stuff, which is great and very complicated. But nobody has asked me about the women's issues. And I was like really thinking about them. But I think probably because feminism has succeeded, at least for female novelists, which is like people don't want to ask about that stuff. Like no one's going to ask me about love or like a bad relationship or something because it's like seen as insulting.
So when you brought up this idea of women's issues, I'm curious about what issues you see in the book that people aren't asking you about.
Oh, I mean, I meant like women's issues as in like the Women's March as like a feminist statement, I think is very interesting because it was like the apotheosis of like the mainstreamification of feminism that I think since then has not, people try and sort of assert that there's like a real feminism somewhere and the sort of Women's March like corporate pink wearing stuff is not the real feminism and the real feminism is like a socialist feminism or something. But I think that it has like too many of these like basically branded associations with it that it can't overcome. And in the book, I think those things appear at various points, like the narrator is reflecting that Felix understands that he can't talk about women's issues to other women, so because he's only going to look stupid or like an asshole, so he just doesn't talk about them. And towards the end of the book, again, in that scene with Nell, when she's having coffee with her, Nell starts talking about like they're regulating women's bodies and starts using this kind of like boilerplate feminist slogan language that irritates the narrator. And then they have this conversation about sexual assault that I hope is kind of, it's interesting. But something that's interesting about that is that in that moment, the narrator is like, Nell asked her if she's ever been sexually assaulted. She says, yes. And everyone who's asked me about that, which has not been that many people, but everyone who's asked me about that assumes that she's telling the truth, even though she's a liar. Like she's then later in that conversation, she says that her boyfriend proposed to her by putting his engagement ring in a Furby and like giving her the Furby for her, for, you know, so like,
because we presume that people wouldn't lie about that, right?
Right, because it's such a feminist like slogan now that women don't lie about those things, and that we have to believe women in this case, even though this is the like least believable woman of all time, right? Like, and I think like what I wanted to do in the book with feminism is to like sort of question these like really hard line attempts to make feminist theory and feminist ideas turn into facts, which they will never, you know, they will never be. She might not have been lying, but we will never know, right? Like the reader can't know. You can't own that story because it's in this inherently unstable form, which is fiction. And also you have an incredibly unstable, unreliable narrator who's telling you this. Even if she's very convincing and very sort of moving when she talks about it, you don't know. And that is kind of what I think we have like lost in this conversation, right? Like an understanding of like what it means to espouse a political idea or to argue for a political position. And I think because these sort of slogans appear online so often and in headlines and in on Twitter and on Instagram, graphic designy cards or whatever, like we're encouraged to think of them as facts, even though they will never be facts, right? Like even if we all agree with them, which I would assume that you and I do more or less, like they will still never be true. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, and in a sense, like this narrator is sort of an embodiment of that idea because, you know, I mean, even earlier in this conversation, you said that this narrator was actually reliable, right? That she, that yeah. she is telling the truth. And then there's so many complications to that idea in the book and to her character. And I think what I'm hearing you say is that we're losing the nuance of it.
Well, yeah, you have to accept that at times she's telling the truth and being earnest, and at times she is lying, you know? And yeah, I do think at times she's reliable. In that moment, is she reliable? People think that she is. I'm not going to like do a J.K. Rowling and be like, in fact, her trauma is this, and I thought, you know, she, you know, her, she growing up, this happened to her, and Dumbledore is actually gay. You know, I'm like, that's not gonna, you know, that's not gonna happen with this character. So I did think about it, but I have not decided if I think that she's telling the truth.
I mean, I'm with the other people that you've talked to because I did not question that. Like, yes, it does come in the midst of what you've, you know, already stated are like lies and, you know, a part of the book where she is putting on so many personas. But yeah, I like obviously many of the people that you've talked to, and maybe because we've been, I don't know, conditioned sounds like an awful way to say it, but we have come to want to believe even that women wouldn't lie about that.
Right. And I also think in this context, too, I mean, she very much said, she's like, well, I'm telling you as my friend, I'm not talking to you as if I'm trying to convince a conservative. But she is also aware of the context in which she's speaking. So I think that she's like creating the sense that she's telling the truth. So, of course, it makes sense that she would. But that also indicates like that there ought to be a difference between the way we speak to our friends or the way that we speak casually in private and the way that we speak publicly. But what sort of disturbing about social media is that it's like supposed to be a combination of the two, but actually it's just public. It's all public. Like even if you have a private account, it's still public.
When you said that, when you said there's got to be this distinction between the public and the private self, I think that's the conversation that is often had about social media, because you are at once like trying to present what is supposed to be like your true self, but it's for public consumption. So how could it be?
Right. And I think your truth self like comes out in sort of strange and like quiet moments or like in action and not in, you know, declaration, right? So you might think through it and sort of arrive at some kind of truth about yourself, but also is there even such a thing as a truth about yourself? I don't really know.
I mean, in that sense, like this, I know I keep harping on it or coming back to it, but in that sense, like the narrator's refusal to kind of get publicly upset over, you know, what would have been a breakup seems in line with that idea, right?
Yeah, I mean, also, you can make judgments about her as a character because of this is how she's acting, right? Like, another character would not do it this, you know, she's kind of weird. Like, another person would not act like this. They might have a total public breakdown, or they might tell their friends about their breakup and, like, do it healthily and, like, move on or whatever. And this character is different. And so, like, I also believe that you can sort of make judgments about people's character based on what they do online. You just can't take it literally, right? Like, you have to sort of interpret it. Like, what does it mean if you're subtweeting people all the time? Or, like, what does it mean if you're, like, making up a different persona online? And what is the relationship between yourself and your persona? It really depends.
I mean, maybe that's just where we are at culturally, is the line is so blurred that that's not a question that's raised often enough. Even though social media is such a present force, you know, in the world right now. But that's not a question that's actually, yeah, raised, or we don't talk about it so much.
Yeah, well, I also think that something that social media does, it, like, puts, like, a ton of people around you. And they're all interpreting, and they all, like, assume that you have this sort of stable basis for interpretation. But actually, like, even the very sort of, you know, someone might be interpreting a Trump statement literally and someone might be interpreting it figuratively, right? Like, as a joke. He would always, like, say that he was joking whenever he was saying certain things, and the media would treat it as a literal statement because, in part, there had been this discussion early on that was, like, I think when he was running, there had been this discussion about how you should take him seriously but not literally. And then people would argue about how, no, you should take him literally. And it was just this sort of, like, endless back and forth that was very frustrating because nobody could agree, like, on the basic terms that they would use to interpret a situation. And I think that that's true of things that are much more sort of banal and, like, everyday than Trump.
The book begins basically at the eve of his inauguration. And really, like, the only mention of him is that introduction. But then you have, you know, when your narrator is in Berlin talking to a bunch of men at a reading, you have them kind of commenting on American politics in a way that she's kind of offended by. Was it a decision not to foreground Trump being kind of this person who's guiding a lot of these changes in rhetoric?
Yeah, well, because I think that a lot of the things that I had observed, the way that the internet was working, the way that people were, like, treating each other online, the way that people were sort of, like, bringing ideas from the internet into the offline, to their relationships, were things that I noticed, like, when I first started working in media and writing online, which was in 2012. So I really didn't want to ascribe a cause, and I didn't want the cause to be, like, the internet is doing this to us, and I didn't want the idea to be that Trump is doing this to us, because I don't think that either of those things is true. And he does create, like, a mood. I think that there is a sort of gravity around him, but the book is, I hope, like, a realist novel in that he appears in a realistic number of ways, which for this kind of person is sort of, like, he doesn't actually affect our life in any way. And I thought that it was important to, like, make it clear that there are no material changes for her, and everybody's like, well, something bad is going to happen, but the bad thing that happens, at least within the course of the novel, is not something that is you can really expect, right? It's not this big apocalypse, and it's not Trump doing something crazy. It's, like, something much weirder, but it is bad.
I think that's a great note to end on. Lauren, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a really great conversation.
Look for more information about Lauren at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.